Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The Prison Policy Initiative has released a new report on the U.S. carceral system entitled Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie 2024. It's a massive undertaking that provides a detailed look at where and why people are locked up in the U.S., dispelling myths and focusing attention on serious issues. Joining me to discuss this new report is Wanda Bertram, communications strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Wanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
Now, first, to refresh the memories of longtime listeners and for the benefit of any new folks out there, tell us about the Prison Policy Initiative.
The Prison Policy Initiative is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We've been around for about 20 years, and our mission is to study and expose the broader harms of incarceration and criminalization in order to spur and empower advocacy campaigns that are attacking mass incarceration and criminalization.
So now, let's get straight to it. This new report entitled Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie 2024. As they say on my favorite news program, let's do the numbers. How many people in the U.S. are behind bars on any given day?
Right. So it's about 1.9 million people. And I should step back and say this is actually the 10th anniversary edition of this report. So the first time we do this report roughly once every year. And in 2014, that was the first time that we put it out. So this year, this is the, you know, it's been 10 years since we released our first report. Back in 2014, actually, I should compare it to the 2015 report, because that was a little bit, that was when we kind of began doing our analysis the way we do it now. In 2015, we calculated that there were about 2.3 million people behind bars. So it seems like, all right, pretty substantial shift, right? From 2.3 million people to 1.9 million people. But unfortunately, the vast majority of that drop happened because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and was not anything intentional that was undertaken by prison systems and jail systems, but was rather just the result of all the gears of the criminal justice system kind of coming to a halt, right? Courts weren't processing cases as fast. Police weren't arresting as many people. Of course, on the opposite end, parole boards weren't releasing as many people. But the aggregate effect was that fewer people went to jail and went to prison in 2020 and 2021. Now, since then, we've seen that the population of prisons and jails and other correctional and confinement facilities is ticking back up gradually again. So, you know, when I say, you know, this is the 400,000 odd, you know, drop in the prison and jail population is nothing to celebrate. The reason I say that is because it's probably all going to eventually bounce back from the pandemic. Not to discount, you know, the significant declines that have been achieved by advocates and by legislators who care about this issue. It's probably responsible for a drop of about 100,000 people in prisons, jails, and other confinement facilities since, you know, 10 years ago. But the pace of that actual reform has not been enough to actually make a sizable and permanent dent in this country's carceral capacity.
Well, and in fairness, the drop because of COVID, this wasn't because the legal system suddenly developed a conscience or a heart. A lot of that was just because it was because of the advocacy of people out there who were, you know, concerned for the lives and welfares of people who were stuck in the system. That's
Right. I mean, that's true. There were changes that happened during COVID-19 as a result of advocacy. And that's nothing to sniff at. And it's important to remember, right? Like the tens of thousands of people who went home from federal prison because of the CARES Act, and because of the, Yeah, because of the changes that happened during COVID. And that was a, you know, there were tons of organizations that pushed really hard for that. But you know, unfortunately, where one of my colleagues likes to say that our organization is in the wet blanket business. So we, you know, I do have to throw a wet blanket on the idea that there's been this massive progress in the, you know, in mass incarceration.
Hey, the truth is the, you know, reality is reality. Flavor Flav said you can't stop reality from being real. Now, one of the things that makes all this complicated is that it's not just a system. It's not like we have a carceral, a carceral system or a legal system any more than we have a healthcare system. We have a bunch of systems, even and the legal system is even worse. You have to be, talk to me about that. This is actually a, it's like a, this is a, it's a big complicated, fragmented system.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because it's not like you said, you know, this is a quote unquote criminal legal system that is made up of thousands and thousands of different jail systems, prison state prison systems, the federal prison system. Our pie chart includes a bunch of other, you know, types of confinement facilities as well, you know, which are not thought about as much, like tribal jails, or as they call them in the government agencies, Indian country jails. You have juvenile facilities, so lockups for kids. You know, you have immigration detention facilities, which are run by the US Marshals or ICE. You have civil commitment and other involuntary commitment facilities, and you know, of course, you've got territorial prisons. So these are all much, you know, we call them smaller slices of the pie, but they're, you know, they all kind of in the aggregate, right? This is a substantial amount of people who, you know, who are incarcerated in the U.S. And it's actually interesting if you look at other countries. Another report that we put out, which we'll likely be updating this year, we compare the US to other countries in terms of its incarceration rate. And we considered trying to incorporate the immigration detention numbers and the youth detention numbers of other countries with the, you know, along with the US. But most other countries, those numbers are barely a blip on the map, right? In addition to having the, you know, the largest prison system and the largest jail system per capita of any country in the world, we also have the largest immigration detention system. We also have the largest juvenile justice system. So across the board, we're, you know, we're an incarceration nation.
One thing about these numbers, the daily population, that's, you know, the 1.9, that's the 1.9 million people behind bars. That's a, on any given day. But that number really is kind of deceptive. Talk to me, friend, if you could, about local jails and churn.
Right. Yeah, the size of the criminal legal system is much larger than anything that we could ever capture in this pie chart that we put out. And that's not a reason not to put it out, but I think that you're right to bring up that so many people cycle through local jails on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis, and they're doing these short stints, meaning that they're, you know, they're you know, we call this jail churn, right? So it's like if you look at the jail population on any given day, you know, you're going to see 600 odd thousand people. But if you look at, you know, the number of people who are going to jails every year, it hovers more around 10 million people. So yeah, this is, you know, this is one way in which a point in time count doesn't really capture it. You could also say the same thing about the misdemeanor system, right? There are some, you know, there's a slice of people who are in jails and prisons who are being held for misdemeanors on any given day. But then there's other, you know, there's some, I think some 13 million misdemeanor charges every single year that, you know, pull people into the court system, often give them a conviction, and then they're spat right out. They may never go to jail, they may never go to prison, right? But they're still impacted by criminalization, by our laws, right? So it's a bigger system than we can capture in any one graphic.
Well, and if they're in the probation and parole systems, and they're still in the kind of gotcha phase where anybody could
Oh,
be
yeah.
put away. Now,
Right.
I want to get to I want to get to some of these the in this new report, this mass incarceration, the whole pie 2024, which folks can find on your website, prisonpolicy.org. You bust some myths about mass incarceration, and I want to ask you about if we could go through a few of my favorites.
Sure.
You start with one of my favorites, the myth that, quote, private prisons are the corrupt heart of mass incarceration, end quote. Now, I'm going to talk about that, but before you do, and I apologize for the spoiler here, but I can sense the people bristling. No one is defending private prisons. The fact is there's a difference between private prisons on the one hand and the broader issue of the privatization of prison services on the other.
Yeah. I think we try to be as clear about this in the report as possible because, you know, there's different kinds of myths about mass incarceration. There are outright lies that are told by, you know, right wingers in order to spur, you know, crime, you know, fears of, you know, crime numbers that aren't real. And then there are just perceptions about mass incarceration that don't line up with what has been happening over the last 10, 20 years, or maybe are a little bit out of date. And that's what, you know, that latter category is where this falls. Private prisons account for about 8% of people who are locked up in this country today. And that's, you know, that's nothing to sniff at. That's a substantial number of incarcerated people. And it points to an industry that's still very much thriving. ICE and GEO Group also are, you know, making tons of money, or excuse me, not ICE, CCA and GEO Group are still making tons of money contracting with ICE, but, and you know, operating those detention facilities for undocumented immigrants. Nevertheless, this is still a really small slice of the pie. The vast majority of people who are being locked up in this country are being locked up in publicly run, publicly operated facilities. And we hear the same atrocious reports of, you know, terrible conditions, exploitation in these public facilities that we hear about with privately run prisons as well. So, you know, we're trying to dispel this myth because, you know, that private prisons and private prison companies have somehow created mass incarceration, because it's just too easy of a way out of understanding that, you know, lawmakers in this country have convinced people to expand and enhance punishments for people and you know, fork over ever more power to the police, to the point where we have, you know, we have this massive, you know, archipelago of prisons and jails that have popped up across the US. And that's not, you know, that's not the result of lobbying by, you know, by a private prison lobby. That's, if anything, the private prison lobby is, you know, is more the symptom of this problem than the cause. But like you said, and I'm sorry, I'm going on and on here, but like you said, there is an element of privatization and mass incarceration that is actually overlooked, which is the presence of companies that are providing telecom services, communication services, healthcare, commissary services, all, you know, and et cetera, to people who are locked up. And those companies, Securus, Keefe Group, right, GTL, I guess it's known as Viapath now, healthcare companies like Horizon, these are, you know, these companies are bringing in million or billions of dollars, you know, every year from incarcerated people and their families, and sometimes kicking back substantial portions of incarcerated people's money to the prison systems themselves. So there is, you know, there do remain these really problematic exploitative relationships between public prisons, public jails, and private companies that people do need to be paying attention to.
Companies, one of my favorites is, of course,
sorry, that was so much.
No. I think it's this is important because I'm very familiar with the arguments over private prisons, and I've been doing this for a long time. So it's, you know, but it is a place where there's been a change. But, you know, it's like, oh, it's not a private; these are publicly run. So which is so much better, I guess. But that's only because we think that there's some kind of accountability. But then you farm out things to the third parties, and you bring in private vendors. So it's not our fault that the healthcare was substandard, that was the vendor's fault. Oh, and they've apologized and made corrections. I don't know if you can hear the air quotes. And you've got, you know, the food service. Sure, it's substandard and it's not really nutritional, but that was our vendor. It's not our fault. So, you know, it's a way of avoiding. It's like an athletic shoe manufacturer using contractors who are located overseas. It's not their fault that they're using forced labor. That was their contractor doing that. And anyway, I digress. I mentioned I live in Oregon, but I digress. This is my conversation with Wanda Bertram, communication strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. anybody who knows me, or Googled me at least, knows that drug policy is my jam. I've been working on drug policy reform and drug legalization for 4 decades. I am so old. And that brings me to another myth which you bust about mass incarceration, that, quote, releasing nonviolent drug offenders would end mass incarceration, end quote. And then that's just not true.
Yeah, what we're pushing back on, you know, when we talk about, you know, this myth that if you just released all of the nonviolent drug offenders, we'd somehow end mass incarceration. We're pushing back on the, you know, the nonviolent label as much as the drug offender label, right? And because I think that this is, you know, so important to think about right now, as, you know, as the fentanyl crisis is spurring recriminalization and enhanced criminalization of drug possession and drug selling, is that drug offenses were not always thought of as nonviolent. Right. There's, you know, we do classify them that way now. And, you know, technically they are, you know, in the legal system that way, as these, you know, nonviolent offenses. But when people were locking up drug offenders, or when people were locking up people for drug crimes, you know, at the height of that mania in the 80s and the 90s, this was thought of as, you know, these people are the worst of the worst. They're spreading, you know, dangerous, lethal chemicals into our communities and giving them to our children. It might have not had a violent label on it, but many of the people who were locked up as a result of this, you know, were still, you know, extremely stigmatized. So looking back and saying, you know, trying to look back at this period and say, oh, we just, you know, we somehow slipped on a banana peel and locked up a bunch of people that we knew didn't do anything wrong, and now we can just release all of those people, really just gets the dynamic of you know, carcerality and punishment entirely wrong. We lock people up because we're scared. Right. And if we're going to move beyond this era of mass incarceration that we're in, we need to somehow find ways of moving beyond the fear. And that, you know, that's a truth that contains lessons for us today, because we need to find ways of dealing with the fentanyl crisis that don't just boil down to we're going to lock up more people and we're going to enhance penalties for people who are found possessing or dealing fentanyl. So that's, you know, that's really the sentiment behind, you know, busting this myth. And if I can get into the data a little bit, what we show here is that if you do look at the total prison population and the total jail population, only 1 in 5 incarcerated people are locked up for a drug offense. So even if you were to release all of them today, you would still just make a dent in mass incarceration, a sizable dent, but just a dent. Right? You'd still be left with, you know, over 1 million people locked up, many for crimes that are considered violent. And then you actually might have an even greater political difficulty, because now, in order to make any more dents in the prison system, you'd have to be proposing reforms that exclusively target, quote unquote, violent offenders. So there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of simplistic thinking, I think, that swirls around, especially, you know, on the left side of the political spectrum, that, you know, if there are these somehow easy reforms that could fix mass incarceration, and that we can just, you know, pretty easily step beyond the mistakes of, you know, prior decades. And that's simply not true. And we need to contend with that.
Now, one of the myths you bust has gotten a lot of traction recently in my home state of Oregon, sadly. The myth goes, quote, some people need to go to jail to get treatment and services, end quote. And that's just a miserable lie. So now talk to me about that one.
Yeah. I mean, this one falls, you know, unfortunately, kind of right between the classic right wing crime fear mongering and the you know, benevolent misunderstandings of incarceration. Because I think a lot of people, when they say, you know, some people just need to go to jail to get treatment or get services for a drug addiction or a mental health problem, they mean well, and they think that that's true. But what we have found in, you know, an analysis of Oregon's treatment capacity and jails and what jails are doing and elsewhere, is that jails actually are not providing people with services. If you look at drug treatment exclusively, only about 54% of local jails even offer treatment for withdrawal. So even if you're a jail and you're not providing people with medication-assisted treatment for an opioid use disorder, even if you're not providing them with, simply like a Narcotics Anonymous kind of program or something like that, you can still do the very, very bare minimum and help people, manage withdrawal that they're going through, but only half of jails even do that, right? So the idea that jails, which have never provided anything remotely close to real healthcare, are suddenly going to start now simply because we have, a more intense public safety issue related to, drugs and mental health than we might have had before, that's really magical thinking. That's very wishful thinking. Beyond which, I think, and this is pertinent to Oregon as well, legislators are proposing to lock people up, who are suffering from, drug addiction or mental health problems, when they don't even have capacity in the communities to deal with those problems, right? In places where people did not even have opportunities to go seek out treatment that would meet their needs before, lawmakers are kind of, jumping the gun and saying, well, I guess they're not getting treatment, I guess we should just lock them up. So this is this is still, the idea that people are going to get treatment if they go to jail is still a very attractive idea that has gotten a lot of traction, and has led to a lot of jails that are expanding, building new beds, saying, oh, don't worry, we're going to incarcerate more people, but we're going to have mental health services and we're going to have drug addiction services built in. And I'm quite frightened by that, because I think this is paving the way for a new era where we invest a lot more in jails without, actually helping people out.
Well, you got to have some place to put people while you're waiting to ramp up the capacity that would actually help. That's just such a, again, forget the rant. Sorry.
No, exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. We're warehousing people. That's really what's happening. You've got cities across the country where there's public drug use and there's, people having mental health crises in public, and people don't like to see that. And the political solution to this is to build a bigger jail and, say, oh, don't, well, we're going to provide services here, when really the purpose of it is to get those people out of sight, right? And who knows if you're going to accomplish anything else in the meantime.
While we have time, I want to move on now quickly to another report you released recently, a related report. It's entitled Women's Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie 2024. It's just, give me the numbers. Let's do the numbers.
Sure. So every year when we produce the Mass Incarceration, the Whole Pie report, we also produce a companion report just about women. And we do this because women's experiences with incarceration tend to be a little bit difficult to suss out in the data because there are so fewer of them. There's about 190,000 women and girls who are locked up on any given day in the U.S. That's, if you'll notice, about 10% of the total incarcerated population. So the vast majority of incarcerated people are men, because of which, there is the women's experiences can be overlooked. So that's why we do this report. And to trying to narrate this visual that we have, this pie chart in the report, there's about 77,000 women locked up in state prisons, about 16,000 in federal prisons, and actually 84,000 locked up in local jails. So in contrast to the overall incarcerated population, where about, I'd say, a quarter to a third of incarcerated people nationwide are held in local jails, for women, it's actually, it's closer to half. And there's actually more women who are held in local jails than are in state prisons. And I can go into why that is in a minute if you'd like. But so we've also, just like our general whole pie, we have the number of girls that are locked up in youth detention facilities. We have immigrant detention numbers. We have Indian country jails. We have territorial prisons. We have civil commitment. So it's a big whole pie, just about women and girls.
So, well, I know that in jails, a lot of people are held in jails without being convicted of a crime, even just because they can't pony up money for bail or they can't afford a good lawyer. Well, combination of not being able to pony up money for bail and not being able to afford a good enough lawyer. According to your report, jails play a major role in this. So, talk to me about that. Is that true with women, or what's the case there?
Right. So, this question of why is it that more women proportionally are being held in local jails? Well, I would say that it's probably not because prosecutors who are adjudicating women's cases see women as uniquely unlikely to appear back in court. I'd say that it's more likely that women are struggling to avoid, or excuse me, struggling to afford the amount of the bail bonds that they're, you know, they're forced to pay to get out. There's a lot of anecdotal reporting that men who are going in the criminal justice system tend to have more in the way of support networks than women who are in the criminal justice system. And there's also the fact that, you know, just simply by the numbers, women who are in jails have lower incomes than men. I think the average income of a woman in jail who can't make bail is $11,000 a year, right? That's, I mean, it's ridiculously low. For Black women, I think it's something like $9,000 a year. So when you consider that the average bail bond for a felony is about $10,000, you're looking at, you know, for a woman in jail, that's a year's income. They can't pay that. And so oftentimes they stay, you know, they're stuck inside.
So what are the consequences of locking up, what are the consequences of this, of our over-incarceration of women?
Right, right. So locking so many women up, in particular in jails, is really distressing, because jails are not equipped in the way that state prisons are, or federal prisons, to give people any kind of long-term care or programming. Now, I'm not saying that prisons are paragons of, offering healthcare or drug treatment or mental health treatment or, educational programming or anything like that. But as we were just talking about, jails have abysmal records when it comes to providing any kind of healthcare or programming to people who are inside. That's because jails are primarily built to house people for short stays while they're waiting for their trials to happen. So when you send as many women as go to jails to jails, that means that, you know, this population of people is, you know, even receiving even fewer services proportionally than men are. I should say here that, you know, although about 60% of women in jails are awaiting trial, about 40% are actually doing short sentences. They've already been convicted. They're serving time for misdemeanors or other low-level offenses, usually terms of around a year or less than a year. But when you consider that, you know, the most women who are in jails come in with a substance use disorder of some kind, often with a serious mental illness, then you have to contend with the fact that we are throwing tens of thousands of women in jails for several months or years at a time. In these facilities where they cannot get any sort of treatment for, you know, the chronic conditions that they're coming in with.
This has been Prison Pipeline. I've been Doug McVeigh. My guest has been Wanda Bertram, communications strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Wanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Wanda Bertram, communications strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Find copies of their reports on mass incarceration, women's incarceration, and a slew of other truly excellent materials on the website prisonpolicy.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just a soul's intentions.